Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. The United States launched a war against Afghanistan in 2001 and another against Iraq in 2003. It's now 13 years later. Despite many trillions of dollars spent and staggering levels of death and destruction, no end to these wars is in sight. No citizen can begin to imagine even what the U.S.'s objectives might be. And Obama has just launched a major escalation of the Iraq War, which now includes Syria too. At first glance, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East would seem to be a catastrophic failure. A failure for the citizen, perhaps, but not necessarily a failure for the ruling elite. I hate to say it, but more destruction, chaos, and terrorism in the Middle East means more profit for the so-called defense industries, more profit for the oil companies, because oil prices will rise, better career opportunities for the generals and admirals. More chaos and terrorism abroad means more excuses to take away still more of the civil liberties that once protected American citizens from their own government. So, what looks like a policy failure to you may look like a policy success to Goldman Sachs, ExxonMobil, Lockheed Martin, the Pentagon, the U.S. State Department, and President Barack H. Obama. So today, I'm resurrecting a show we did on the very theme, broadcast back in September 2008. Since then, the name of the president has changed, but very little else. The show is titled, Policy Failures. Or are they? I hope you'll stay tuned. Today's program features little of me, a song or two by James McMurtry, and selections from Fine Talks by Naomi Klein and Michael Parenti. The common theme? When things are screwed up, don't assume that the screw-up wasn't intentional. Canadian journalist Naomi Klein has a new book out, Disaster Capitalism. In it, she argues a scary and entirely plausible thesis. When things go wrong, it's not necessarily because our leaders are incompetent. There's much money to be made in snafus for many industries. So many powerful people and businesses have a vested interest in seeing that disasters are not prevented. For example, our wars in the Middle East have driven the cost of petroleum through the roof. Each threat of war with Iran sends the price of a barrel of oil still higher. Who profits? Not you or I, but the stockholders and oil companies are doing well, thank you. The people who own most oil company stock were already rich. Now they're getting rich beyond imagination. ExxonMobil is now posting profits of something like $8 billion per quarter. Not $8 billion in sales, $8 billion in net profit per quarter. Say, doesn't the Bush family have some financial interest in oil? Say, aren't at least some Bushes starting wars in the Middle East and threatening to start another? Later in the program, historian Michael Parenti will carry these points farther. Naomi Klein will do so now. In this excerpt, Klein identifies three rising industries that are profiting handsomely from our man-made disasters. The disasters of global warming, world poverty, and astounding levels of economic inequality. Industries that are profiting include seeds for drought-resistant crops, protection of the rich, and surveillance and containment of migrating poor people. Here's Naomi Klein.
One of the things that I'm trying to challenge these days is some of the discourse around, you know, the war in Iraq being a failure, the war in Iraq being a disaster. You know, obviously it's a disaster for Iraqis. More than a million Iraqis have died. It's a disaster for U.S. taxpayers. It's a disaster for U.S. soldiers. But it is not a disaster for everyone. The occupation of Iraq has really turned that country into a laboratory for privatized warfare and occupation. And what we see is that the longer the occupation wears on, the more privatized it becomes, and the more it becomes this laboratory for all of these private security companies to take on functions that they never have had before or not for many years, like prisoner interrogation or the complete running of the green zone in the case of Halliburton, which is really sort of like a city state for Halliburton. What the stage we're at now is that all these companies that got a taste of a kind of a corporate rule in Iraq, and right now in Iraq there are 180,000 private contractors and only 160,000 foreign soldiers. So there are more private contractors than there are soldiers. And this has a knock-on effect, because in all of the other war zones, like Afghanistan, Colombia, the line is, well, we don't have enough soldiers, so we need to fill it in with mercenaries. And Blackwater has been going around saying, let us into Darfur. They want to, you know, they're saying the UN can't do it, we'll do it. So all these companies that got a taste of this in Iraq are now looking to diversify. They're not sure how long this is going to last, but they're looking to diversify. And I think it's really important for us to look at where they see their growth industries, okay? Blackwater is a particularly interesting company to look at because it's so telling. I mean, they see three growth areas. And it's always important to remember that Eric Prince, the CEO of Blackwater, said that he wanted to do for the U.S. military what FedEx did for the post office, okay? He sees himself as fully within the neoliberal paradigm, but taking it to its final frontier, okay? And he sees three areas: genocide prevention, okay, in Darfur; the response to natural disasters, i.e. responding to the increasing numbers of disasters as a result of global warming; and border control. They have just opened a new base 3 miles from the border with Mexico. There was a huge fight about it because the community that they were supposed to open up in, called Potrero near San Diego, kicked them out. They found another community and they've opened up because they have said that they see the border as a major new industry. Halliburton got a major contract to build prisons for in the case of a sudden influx of refugees. Now, this is all connected because, of course, we have an economic model that constantly produces disasters and crises, which constantly produce mass migration, whether it's NAFTA, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's a war. So there's now the ability to profit from those disasters and also to profit from containing the people who move in the cases of those disasters, and also to profit from saving the wealthy, saving the elites, from the living with the effects of these disasters. So there's, for instance, some of you have heard me talk about this before, a private company that was launched a year after Hurricane Katrina in Florida called HelpJet. And HelpJet is a charter airline whose slogan is that we'll turn your hurricane into a luxury vacation. And they work on the country club model, where you pay an annual fee, and if a hurricane is coming to your part of coastal Florida, they will let you know, and they will arrange for you to get out of the hurricane zone, take you to the private airport terminal, whisk you off to the resort of your choice, to the 5-star resort of your choice. Now, we are literally getting into this kind of a phase, and during the wildfires in California last summer, we saw something that we hadn't seen in more than 100 years, which is private firefighters showed up in the wealthiest areas working for the insurance giant AIG. If you lived in the wealthiest areas that were hit by the forest fires, you paid extra on your insurance premium, and as part of being a VIP member, your home was sprayed down with this white foam sort of fire retardant, and your home was protected and your neighbor's was not. Now, everyone was shocked by this. In the 8 months since then, 5 of AIG's competitors have announced that they too, and wildfire season is coming, and this year there will be 5 more insurance companies offering VIP private firefighting protection, okay? So this is the way the market is responding to global warming. Do we get it? Okay? Not with solar and wind, not with moving to green energy and sustainable living, but actually by reenacting the rapture on Earth. It is a huge industry, and we have to understand that we are not all in this together. This is something that was also said this morning, that we were talking about the similarities with the biblical myths of escape. You know, the boat's coming, you and your friends can get on, everyone else can drown. You know, there's a big elevator in the sky coming to take you and your friends. And one of the speakers earlier today said, you know, only the rich can afford to press eject. And so I think there's a lot of naivete sometimes in our environmental discourse where it's sort of like, you know, at least even Dick Cheney has grandkids, you know, we just have to hold hands, we're all in it together, raise awareness. You know, Dick Cheney's going to Dubai. We need to understand this with his grandkids. We see the growth areas responding to global warming. By the way, Monsanto has been buying up hundreds of patents on what they call climate-ready seeds. Seeds that are resistant to the effects of global warming, salination, drought. And this VIP disaster rescue and containing and surveilling the disposed of people, the displaced people, the migrating people. All of this is the new face of neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Naomi Klein says that we do too little to prevent disasters because powerful forces stand to make money from the disaster. President Bush's Middle East policy itself has been called a disaster. Not really, says Michael Parenti. Bush has accomplished almost everything he wanted, and the ruling elite have profited tremendously. Parenti discusses two programs that are often called failures. The failure of the IMF and World Bank to lift third world citizens out of poverty, and the failure of the invasion to make Iraq a freer and more democratic nation. He argues that the neoliberal policies of the IMF and World Bank and the Iraq War look like failures only if you fail to grasp their real purpose. Let's listen.
What they do in the world, U.S. rulers, they do on purpose. They know what they're doing. Just because they mislead you and confuse you or us doesn't mean that they are necessarily confused. They may say all sorts of misleading things. I wrote an article and I pointed out that as U.S. investment has increased over the last half century dramatically in the third world, and IMF and World Bank loans have increased in the third world, and U.S. aid to the third world has increased. While all of this has gone on for half a century, during that half a century, poverty has increased. Today, the number of people living in poverty is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. So as wealth accumulates, poverty spreads. Well, there's no mystery, really. Unless you assume that these investors and these aid people and these bankers manipulating this debt are doing all this to help the people in these countries, if you drop that assumption and you say they're doing it to help themselves, then it's a perfectly rational system. They're making tremendous amounts of money. These investments aren't designed to uplift the people, to build up their domestic industries, to give them a viable economy, to make their food supply secure and those things. These investments are there to get them off the land, to take the wealth out of them, to reduce the price of their labor down to shantytown starvation levels. And so is the aid. All these countries have to buy it from U.S. And so with the debt, the loans are sent in and then they're trapped in the loan and then they're hit with more money sent to them and they're forced to do SAPs, it's called SAPs, structural adjustment programs, which means cut back on all your own domestic subsidies and development and all that. So these programs are designed to impoverish these people and they've been very successful. And the liberal critic comes along and says, this isn't working, because he's smarter. He's so much smarter than all these people who've been doing this all this while. No, he isn't. He's the dumbest one in the room. He always thinks that American foreign policy is so stupid and so confused and our dealings with these countries are off on a wrong leg and all that. Why? Well, Larry McGuire writes to me, says, I loved your article, and it answered the question that I posed in mine. He was trying to understand international finance and what happened in Argentina. And he read three liberal writers. He read Mark Cooper of The Nation, Mark Cooper, who never met a U.S. war he didn't love and support, Mark Weisbrot, and Paul Krugman of The New York Times. All three of them writing about Argentina. And McGuire, with feigned innocence, he notes that all three said that Argentina had been a gold mine for international investors and big speculators, a source of huge profits. You remember when Argentina crashed, when the whole economy went into a burnout. The IMF forced Argentina to slash its protective tariffs, privatize its state enterprises, and transfer huge sums from Argentine taxpayers to the pockets of the big moneyed people and the IMF. McGuire, he notes that Cooper, Weisbrot, and Krugman condemn the crisis in Argentina. That these three say that the IMF, and these are various quotes, created a failed model, the program was an error, a catastrophic failure, a failed experiment, a disaster. But Maguire says, how so? Agreed, it was a disaster for the Argentinians and for Argentina. But the free market IMF policies made Wall Street cheer, as Krugman himself said, and it reaped billions for investors. In other words, the policy worked very well for a small group of very wealthy people. Isn't that what the policy was supposed to do? Maguire asks. The IMF has pursued these same policies in many other countries. If an institution does the same thing over and over again with profitable results, why is it a failure? Because it brought hardship to the people of these countries? What's that got to do with getting rich? As Maguire says, I quote him, I would call it a well-crafted policy that must work for the people implementing that policy. Otherwise, why would they continue doing it? That old Roman question, cui bono, that's Latin. It means what? Who benefits? That's right. Who's getting it? Who's benefit? This is being done because somebody is benefiting it in most cases. Now, the same for the war in Iraq. That the reasons given by the administration to justify that war, weapons of mass destruction, Al-Qaeda links to Hussein, that these reasons have proven false, doesn't mean that the policy is imbecilic. As I said to you already, because our rulers try to mislead us and confuse us, doesn't mean that they themselves are confused. The war in Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the war in Iraq is not a stupid blunder. It's not a well-intentioned undertaking that went wrong. Iraq has been very good for a number of interests. It served notice to the Middle East and the world that countries that chart an independent, self-defining, self-developing course will be destroyed. That's just what Cheney said yesterday on that aircraft carrier about Iran, that it might try to emerge as a regional power, and we've got to make sure that doesn't happen. What bothers them is that here's a country that's charting an independent course. It's not putting itself under the free market global system. And that's what was wrong with Iraq. Saddam Hussein was Washington's poster boy years ago. The Iraqi people had a revolution in 1958, and they kicked out the British and American oil companies, and they built a democratic country. When every time they talk about, we've got to go in there and teach the Iraqis democracy, there's a lie. There's the lie of omission. They forget that they had a democracy. They had a constitutional government, a prime minister. Saddam Hussein's first gig with the CIA was to shoot the prime minister, which he did. He didn't kill him. We just wounded him, and the CIA got him out and brought him to Syria. He later on worked his way in, and with his death squads, he killed, or he drove into exile, or he drove underground. Every constitutionalist, every progressive, every reformer, every Democrat, every communist in the country who had formed this coalition. He even then killed and slaughtered and murdered the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist party. This is the part they never tell you about Saddam Hussein. And when he was doing that, he was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They gave him aid. They gave him a good chunk of the oil market. They gave him, they signed him on Iran to go fight, do a proxy war for them against Iran. He was everything. But then he started committing economic nationalism. He kept the economy state-owned. He trained cadres of engineers. He did not turn Iraq into a free market client state. He did not open it up to global international investment. He did not say, come on in, boys, it's all yours. The land, the labor, the resources, the oil, everything. It's all yours. Just give me and my brother a payoff and all that, and we'll take care and keep the people in line for you. He didn't do that. He was a right-winger conservative, but he did keep a lot of these social programs anyway. That didn't fit very well. Iraq was the example. It was a bad example for the Middle East. It was the example, the danger of a good example. We call it that. If every country in the Middle East starts doing that, or in the world, what happens to the empire, what happens to our free market global system of earning billions and billions and billions of dollars off the sweat, labor, and land and resources of these people. So that was accomplished. You see, this war did accomplish something. It took a independent, self-defining, self-developing country and destroyed it. It may making the world that much safer for the free market global empire. Iraq was good for other people. 100 companies made billions in government contracts. 113 billion barrels of quality crude. At today's prices, we're talking about $6 or $7 trillion, the biggest resource grab in history. Saddam was granting concessions to Russia, China, Brazil, Italy, Malaysia, France. All those concessions no longer exist. They're gone. It's the U.S. and Great Britain, this last March, the accords they worked out. If and when they want to get all that, they get all that oil out. A lot of it is also to keep the oil off the market, to keep the oil prices up. And that was the fight, the first Gulf War with Daddy Bush, that's what the whole fight was, that Saddam wanted a larger oil quota, and he wasn't getting it. And if he did, that would bring oil prices down. That's not my conspiracy theory. That's not my lefty conspiracy theory. That was right in the goddamn New York Times business page. It just said, Iraqi oil might threaten price floors, blah, blah, blah. The Iraq war also allowed the U.S. to impose, the White House to impose record increases in the defense budget by 30-40%, depending on how you calculate that defense budget. Iraq had switched from dollars to euros as its reserved currency, that is the currency that any other country will take, it's your backup currency. Not anymore. That was a danger. That was a real danger to U.S. creditors and speculators and international dollar finance, which it's back on the dollar. One of the first things that happened is Iraq has switched back from euros to dollars. Iraq supported Palestinian liberation. Not anymore. Iraq had an entirely state-owned economy. Not anymore. Everything has been privatized or destroyed, one way or the other. Iraq was prosperous and of some influence in the Middle East. Not anymore. Iraq today is a total basket case. It's a disaster. It's worse than Haiti. It may never recover, not for the next foreseeable one or two or three generations. I don't know. It's just terrible what's happened. Now, this is not U.S. ignorance or confusion at work. This is not good intentions gone awry. It is deliberate, conscious reactionism and imperialism. Bush and Cheney knew what they wanted to do, and they have done it for the most part. They've accomplished quite a bit from their perspective.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes is produced at WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. Until next time, from the spacious underground studios of WWUH, here's wishing you a good week. Illegitimi non carborundum. Try to speak the truth and keep the faith.